Y'all doing all right today? All right, good, good. Well, my name's Carter, if we haven't met, and I'm one of the pastors here. I'm thankful you're with us, especially if you're new. I just want to say a special welcome to you. As a church, we want to see people go from restless to redemption. We live in a very restless culture, and we know that we have a redeeming Savior who gives us rest, and we want to share that with the whole world. And so I'm glad you're here today, hopefully to find a little bit of rest as we get into a new sermon series today. But hey, is anybody else pumped for the end of school, beginning of summertime? Okay, good. A little bit. Maybe some people are kind of excited about that. That's great. Okay. I know my grade school, you know, students and my teachers are ready for it to be over. My wife's a teacher, and so she's definitely counting down the minutes, maybe even the seconds, until school ends next week for her. So we're getting excited about that. But one of the things that I wanted to do is just give you an encouragement, maybe a little bit of a warning, or maybe it's a challenge. Let's call it a challenge to be positive, okay? I want to give you a challenge because as you enter into a restful season over the summer, for a lot of us, we go on vacations, we check out of our normal routines, they kind of get, you know, changed. When your normal routines are getting messed up or changed, don't let your relationship with God or His people get messed up or changed. Okay, I just want to give you that encouragement or that challenge because what you want to do is use the summer months to really grow closer to God. Especially as you go on vacation and you do other things and you travel. Those are all beautiful, good, godly things. But man, don't let your relationship with God suffer. Don't let your relationship with the church suffer for that. I just wanted to give you that. And I hope that our teaching series will help encourage you in this. Over the next several weeks, we're going to be in Exodus together, the first part of Exodus, in this sermon series called Delivered from Slavery to Worship. God delivers us from things that we are enslaved to, but He delivers us to things that are good for us and life-giving. And so we'll see that over the next few weeks. And as a church, we've been focusing on, like I said during the prayer moment, learning to listen to God. Now, that's been very challenging for us because learning to listen to God means we can't listen to ourselves or other things. We have to learn to listen to Him. And listening isn't just hearing. What else is it, church? It's obeying, right? Yeah, I heard some people say it. Thank you. It's not just hearing, it's obeying. And we're going to see that very vividly in Exodus together with Israel, God's chosen people in the Old Testament. Exodus has some really important things that God wants to say to us, I believe. And it's not just Israel's story, it's also our story. That's what we're going to learn here because every one of us knows what it's like to live under things that enslave us. And Exodus reveals a God who's willing to deliver us from those things and into something much greater. So today we're going to be in Exodus chapter 1, if you want to turn there or find it on your Bible app. We also have paperback Bibles in the pew in front of you. If you want to borrow that or use it today, you're welcome to take it with you if you need a copy of God's Word. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk about one of the most fundamental forces in human history. We're going to talk about fear. Fear. Fear changes you. Some of our more mature members, and what I mean by mature is older members, some of our older members might remember a very disturbing and difficult circumstance that came up in 1982 in the Chicago area, the Chicagoland area. There were a group of people that died, about seven people that died, taking cyanide-laced Tylenol capsules. They called it the Tylenol murders. It was the beginning of one of those kind of moments in national history. And as those things tend to do, it led to mass panic all over the United States. Suddenly, people were very terrified to do just normal, everyday things. Stores pulled their products off of their shelves. They redesigned packaging so that they were tamper-proof, if you remember the tamper panic moment at that time. The government got involved, and they passed laws as a result of this. I mean, things changed. Things moved. And some of that caution probably made sense, of course. But historians will point to moments like that to show what fear does to people. And fear changes you. It changes everything. When people are afraid, they become suspicious. They grasp for control. They start protecting themselves at all costs, no matter what. And when fear spreads through leaders and nations, oh my, the consequences, then they get proportionally very destructive and devastating. So Exodus 1, we'll see a story of a fearful ruler who's trying to save himself and maybe Egypt with consequences that are devastating. And underneath of this chapter is going to be one central truth that we're going to see together today. This is our main point if you like to take notes. Fear can either enslave you or free you. Fear changes you. And it can either enslave you or it can free you. It all depends on what you fear. Pharaoh's fear is very destructive in the story, we'll see. He grasps for control that he doesn't really have. He essentially tries to undo all the blessings of God on God's people that he's given to Israel. But we'll see this other kind of fear show up. And we called it last year, we talked about this last fall, healthy fear. And that kind of fear is really the fear of the Lord. It's fearing God. Not all fear is bad. It all depends on what you fear. One kind of fear makes people controlling and destructive and enslaved. This other kind of healthy fear produces courage and obedience, wisdom, and ultimately freedom in your life. Exodus 1 is going to force us to ask this question: which fear has the most power over your heart? What do you fear the most? Because it'll shape what you trust, how you respond under pressure. It'll change how you treat people. It'll change every decision you make, ultimately who you're becoming as a human being. So as we talk through this story together today, I want you to notice the contrast of the two fears: the fearful king who's trying to save himself or Egypt with his own power, and then a couple of people who have the fear of God. And that changes everything about them because they have courage and they bring life, and there's healing as a result of that. So let's go ahead and begin with chapter 1, verse 1. We're going to walk through this, and I'll explain it as we go. But listen, I just wanted to tell you, we're going to cover a lot of text. It's a big story, but I do think it's engaging enough to keep your attention. So I hope you'll lock in and follow along with this, because it's a very, very interesting story. So here we go. Exodus chapter 1, verse 1. This is how it begins. These are the names of the sons of Israel, that is Jacob, who moved to Egypt with their father, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. In all, Jacob had 70 descendants in Egypt, including Joseph, who was already there. And in time, Joseph and all his brothers died, ending that entire generation. But their descendants, the Israelites, had many children and grandchildren. In fact, they multiplied so greatly that they became extremely powerful and filled the land. Now, before we read any further in this, let's make sure that we're understanding the setting that this is giving us. Exodus begins with this genealogy because it wants to connect us back to the story in Genesis. Now, we've been through Genesis together as a church over the last 5 years. You can go back and listen to those on our website. But Exodus is the second book in the Bible, and right away we're reminded of Abraham's promises from God here. This is what we see. That's why we have the genealogy. God promised to bless Abraham so that he could be a blessing to the nations. And if you remember, he renamed Jacob, one of Abraham's descendants here, Israel. So he has a new name. Jacob's name originally meant grasping at the heel of his brothers or grasping for control on his own. God changed it to Israel, which is wrestling with God. So he goes from being this idolater, essentially, who's grasping for control on his own, grasping at his own life and power, and he's deceiving people as a result, to a guy who has a relationship with God and he wrestles with God. And now there's a whole group of people that are blessed as descendants of Jacob who are now Israelites because of that. In other words, Exodus starts with God's promises already at work. And so that's the first thing I want us to see. It's a very theological point, but it's very important. So I think, sometimes I do practical points. This is very theological about what's going on in the text. And it's important for us to get. We need to put a pin in this for later because we're going to see this play out over the course of Exodus. See, God had promised Abraham, I will make you into a great nation, and now that's happening. It's beginning to happen. There's multiplication going on. What started as a family of 70 is now becoming thousands, turning into a nation of people. They were fruitful and multiplied. Some translations will say fruitful here. They were fruitful and multiplied greatly and filled the land. That's creation language from Genesis chapter 1. You go back to Genesis 1. That's what it says there. So God's fulfilling his promises in all different levels here, not just to Abraham, but in creation. He's fulfilling his promises to humanity, and he's keeping his promises. They're already at work, but it also kind of feels incomplete, okay? Because still, they're in the land, but they're in Egypt. They're not in the land God promised Abraham. So that's not fulfilled yet. And they've been there for about 400 years. Now, you talk about having to wait for God to fulfill his promises. I mean, 400 years is a long time to wait. You know, you're like, okay, God, you're fulfilling your promises, but not yet. 400 years, I mean, that's double the age of the United States, right? Like, America's not even that old. So they're waiting for God to see fulfillment. They see his faithfulness, but they don't see fulfillment yet. And interestingly, at this point in the story, we don't even see God mentioned. Did you notice that in the genealogy? God's not mentioned yet, and he's not going to be for a little while. It almost feels like they're just kind of moving along in life, as we all feel. Maybe God doesn't feel present. He kind of feels a little absent because he's absent in the story. That's not by accident. The author leaves God out for a while for a reason. Let's keep going. Verse 8. Eventually, a new king came to power in Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph or what he had done. And he said to his people, "Look, the people of Israel now outnumber us and are stronger than we are. We must make a plan to keep them from growing even more. If we don't, and if war breaks out, they'll join our enemies and fight against us. Then they will escape from the country." So the Egyptians made the Israelites their slaves. They appointed brutal slave drivers over them, hoping to wear them down with crushing labor. They forced them to build the cities of Pithom and Ramses as supply centers for the king. But the more the Egyptians oppressed them, the more the Israelites multiplied and spread, and the more alarmed the Egyptians became. So the Egyptians worked the people of Israel without mercy. They made their lives bitter, forcing them to mix mortar and make bricks and do all the work in the fields. They were ruthless in all their demands. So now we'll stop here because, I mean, eventually things are turning bad for Israel. And they began to suffer, right? But why? What caused that suffering? Well, I mean, God doesn't look like he's there. That's one thing. That's a perspective there. We can say, well, where's God? But also we see there's fear. Fear from Egypt, fear from Pharaoh. He sees the blessing that they have, and he's threatened by it. That's interesting. So he uses his power to oppress and enslave them as a result of their blessing. And we don't read stories like this just to learn ancient history. We read them because they expose something deep in the human heart. So we're learning to listen here. Remember, let's listen to what God would be saying to us. It'd be easy to read this and think, oh, well, Pharaoh was just a bad dude. He was evil. There's evil people in the world. They want to oppress God's people. And that's partly true. That's part of it. We could also read, well, where was God? Like, why didn't he stop this? Where is he in moments of need like this? And we could ask that too fairly. But Exodus is really forcing us to ask a deeper question on this. I want to work through two of those questions in particular that are pretty deep. The first one is, why was Pharaoh afraid? Let's work through that. Why was he afraid of their blessing? But then what is this text driving us to wrestle with in it, in the truth that we find there? So first, why is Pharaoh afraid? Well, he's afraid because these seemingly insignificant people have grown in size and influence, and he feels like they have more power than he does, than the nation of Egypt does. He's afraid their blessing isn't going to, listen to this, isn't going to translate to a blessing for Egypt. He's afraid that the blessing of Israel isn't going to translate to a blessing for them and their people. And that's often how people in the world think. Here's what you can write down if you're taking notes. Fearful people often see someone else's blessing as a threat to their own. That's a result of fear in the heart. They see it as a threat to what they could have. They'll think, man, when somebody else is blessed, that means I can't be. When somebody else has what I want, I need to stop them and take that for myself. Man, that's envy at its most basic level, right? Envy is fueled by fear. There's a fear there. But even if we try to give Pharaoh the benefit of the doubt and say, well, he was just looking out for his people. He didn't want them to be overcome, you know. He saw it as a zero-sum game. If Israel was blessed, Egypt couldn't be, and that's just how it was. But what's ironic is that God promised to bless Israel so that they could be a blessing to the other nations, including Egypt. That was the promise from God. Pharaoh didn't know God, though, did he? So he couldn't trust the promises of God, and his fear took over and controlled him and led to destruction and chaos across the land, especially for the Hebrews. But here's the even greater irony in all of this. Pharaoh thinks that he's the one with the power. He thinks he's the one that can control things, right? But he's actually been enslaved long before he ever enslaved the Hebrew people. He was enslaved to fear. His fear is what's controlling him. It's driving him. His insecurity is driving his decisions and his actions. Fear has already become his master, which leads to the second thing I want to point out here. Whatever controls us becomes our master. Whatever controls our emotions, whatever controls our feelings like this, whatever controls us and our decisions, it's our master. The word translated enslavement here in the Hebrew is the word avad, or abad is how they would probably say it. It's A-V-A-D, abad. And it's the only word used in the phraseology of this text. There's no slavery, there's no work, there's none of that, service. You know, our translations use synonyms because it would be really boring if we read it. Just avad, avad, avad. They had to avad, and they made them avad, and they were to avad. That's how it is the whole time. Why is that? Well, it's because the author wants us to see the monotony of it. It just becomes this normal, everyday, boring, almost boring type of monotonous thing to be enslaved. It just grinds you down over time. And I think the author is just emphasizing the nature of enslavement. He wants us to feel it in this text. I mean, it's mentioned, that word avad is mentioned five times just in two verses, verses 13 and 14. It's over and over and over again. And I'm willing to bet we all know that feeling of being ground down under something. It just becomes monotonous and just this, oh man, we're under the burden of it over and over and over again, because slavery to sin rarely feels like something dramatic at first. It just kind of feels normal, but it becomes this weight on you that you didn't even realize was there until you finally do. I'm just like checking your phone every 5 minutes because you're afraid of missing something. That feels normal, but I'll tell you what, it's not. It's slavery. Or like lying awake at night, mentally rehearsing conversations that you've had during the day because you need people to approve of you. That feels normal. You're like, oh, it's just my personality. That's not normal. That's enslavement. Okay? Or it's like constantly working harder because your identity is wrapped up in what you can achieve. So you got to get more hours. You got to make people feel like they can trust you more because of how good you are at your job and all of these different things. Or it's like needing more money to have more security, more success, more validation in your life. But somehow none of those things are ever enough. It's because you're enslaved to a master that is controlling you. And you finally realize it if you're paying attention. Because fear, as an emotion, can be revealing if we let it. Fear exposes what controls us. That's what makes fear helpful as an emotion. It shows us what we trust to save us if we'll let it. Because fear drives so much of our sin in a lot of ways. Think about it. Fear of failure can really enslave us to endless achievement. Or fear of rejection can enslave us to constantly craving others' approval. Or fear of suffering can enslave us to always looking for comfort and pleasure. It's the seat of pornography addiction. Or fear of losing control can enslave us to anxiety or manipulation of others. Fear that you don't matter can enslave you to comparison all the time. Fear of self-promotion or fear of being exposed can enslave us to lying and running from other relationships and putting up walls and masks. See, fear exposes what's really controlling our hearts, because whatever we trust to save us from those fears eventually becomes our master. And we will do what it says at all costs to drive the fear away. That's what we see Pharaoh doing in the story. His fear of the Hebrews revealed his master, and it was power over the land, control over his people and over what was going on. And it'll eventually lead to his downfall, as you know, if you could read ahead in the story, which we won't get to in this series. We're going to do the wilderness probably next year, okay? Or maybe at the beginning of next year. We'll see what that timing looks like. But you guys remember the story. They go off into the wilderness, and he takes his army, which is, again, ironically, his power, the seat of his power, he thinks. Whole army's wiped out in the Red Sea. All of his power gone, just like that. It'll be his downfall. It leads to his destruction because his fear is in the wrong thing, you see. For now, we see that it leads him to dehumanize Israel. And he treats them so badly, really abusing his power that God has given him to oppress, not to bless. People with power, leadership, they should be blessing those that they lead. This leads to him to oppress those in the land, the Hebrews. And then he eventually calls on the very ones delivering babies among the Hebrews to kill the boys who were born. Verse 15, it says, "Then Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, gave this order to the Hebrew midwives, Shiphrah and Puah. When you help the Hebrew women as they give birth, watch as they deliver. And if the baby is a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live." Now, there's some power dynamics in play there, probably ancient kind of like warrior mentality, right? You let the women live so that you can use them as concubines or wives or slaves. You kill the men so they can't fight against you. But because the midwives feared God, this is the turning point, verse 17, because the midwives feared God, they refused to obey the king's orders. They allowed the boys to live too. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives. "Why have you done this?" he demanded. "Why have you allowed the boys to live?" "The Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women," the midwives replied. They are more vigorous and have their babies so quickly that we cannot get there in time. Very interesting. Don't know what happened there. It looks like Pharaoh bought that. I don't know, you know? Clearly they lied. Maybe Pharaoh wasn't the sharpest tack in the drawer. I don't know. But it says, verse 20, as a result, so God was good to the midwives. And the Israelites continued to multiply, growing more and more powerful. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people, throw every newborn Hebrew boy into the Nile River, but you may let the girls live. That's interesting because you think it's going to turn out good after that. And you're like, oh man, the midwives come in and God blesses them. Oh, but no. Pharaoh still, he doubles down. He goes further down the road of death and destruction. Here's the basic point that I want you to get from this. Worldly fear is destructive. This is the unhealthy fear, man. It's destructive. It destroys everybody involved. Pharaoh's fear is now causing mass destruction of human life in the Hebrew nation, in the Israelites. Leaders who lead from fear often sacrifice human value. We see that very often in our culture today. So I cannot pass by without speaking to the direct way that we see this in our culture through abortion. And I know this often makes people uncomfortable, but abortion is clearly driven by fear. A lot of you guys know I worked at what's typically called a crisis pregnancy center for about 6 years when I lived in Greensboro. And my job there, I was one of the executives that led the organization. And this is not anecdotal. I mean, you know, this was our experience. 99 times out of 100, one of our nurses or one of our peer advocates would sit across from a woman who was seriously considering or determined to have an abortion. Why? 99 times out of 100? She was afraid. It was fear. Fear drove that. She was afraid of what it would mean for her future. She was afraid that she didn't have the resources and tools to do it. She was afraid she'd be a bad mother. She was afraid of what other people would think of her. She was afraid of everything. And guess what our culture says? Oh, we'll legalize that so that you can follow through with that. You know what? We agree. You can't do it. As a matter of fact, some people will say, you shouldn't do it. It's your right. You should do it because you can't do it. Now, they don't think they're saying that, but that's what they're saying. So unempowering. So devaluing. Not only to the baby's life, but to her life. Man, as Christians, that cannot be our message. We have to create a new narrative. We cannot look in at somebody's situation and say, that child has no value because of you're too poor. Oh man, it's going to be awful for them. They're going to be born into a horrible circumstance, so they don't deserve life. No, no. That's fear. Maybe that's our own fear if we agree with that. We need to confront that in our lives. And listen, I want you to know if you've had an abortion or if you've encouraged somebody in abortion, I want you to just ask yourself for a moment, what motivated you to that? Because I guarantee it wasn't God. It was fear or something like that. But I also want to say before we move on, you can turn to God for grace and forgiveness. Your abortion or your involvement in that does not have to define you. It doesn't. And there's no sin too big for God to deliver us from because his power is so much greater than any earthly influence, including the fear that we feel in those moments. There is forgiveness. There is grace. And we need to make sure that we preach that. That's what we offered to those women in that crisis pregnancy center. And I'll tell you what, when they heard the gospel, that's what they needed most of the time because they were so afraid. But then something changed. They went from a worldly fear to a healthy fear. And that's what we see in the story because that's what the midwives teach us, isn't it? As they enter into the story, they show us this different kind of fear, the fear of God. And the fear of God frees us from lesser fears. Man, that's such good news, isn't it? Because Pharaoh's fear leads to this violence and destruction, devaluing human life. But it's juxtaposed to the midwife's fear. And when they come in, they fear God. But what happens? They're not terror. It's not a terror fear. We've talked about this a lot this year. The fear of the Lord isn't a terror. That's not what it is. It's a respect. It's an awe. It's worship of God. They fear God in the right way. And when they come in with that kind of fear, notice what happens. Man, life is preserved. People are valued. Courage is displayed. Evil is subverted, right? Good things begin to happen. And there's hope. There's hope. That's not accidental in the story. The narrative is showing us that fear of God restores our humanity and frees us from the lesser fears that lead to destruction. But also notice these medical professionals at the time are the ones on the front line for this. And I know we got a lot of medical professionals in our church, and I just wanted to remind you, man, you have an obligation to value all human life. You have a unique role in preserving. You took a Hippocratic oath to do that. All human life, unborn, all the way to the moment of death, right? It's cheesy, but it's true, from womb to tomb, okay? And I just want you to know that you have that responsibility, and I hope you feel the weight of that, but you can trust God. And if you fear Him, He will use you to bring hope in people's lives. You've probably already seen it. So I hope that that sits heavy on you in a good way. But the fear of God frees you from any lesser fears of losing your colleagues' respect, losing your job and having to do something else, not making as much money because you didn't get the promotion, whatever it might be. Listen, in other words, God has to become so big to us that everything else is small in comparison to Him. Everything. His presence is so real. His power is so true. We believe it so deeply. The things like Pharaoh's power or losing our job or anything else that might cause us fear pales in comparison to God and His power. That's why Christians over time develop this desire to do good and right, not because we're naturally bent in that direction. We're not naturally courageous. We're not naturally going to want to resist evil in our lives. We're not even doing it out of a religious obligation because we fear God's judgment or like He's going to be angry at us. No. It's simply because now we have such a big view of God and His power. He's worked that in us. We believe that He's more powerful than anything, and we know that obedience to Him leads to blessing in our lives. That's why we're obedient, not out of fear of any kind of judgment or reprisal, but out of fear as in awe, worship. We know His power is so much greater than anything else. So God blessed the midwives in the story as a result of their obedience. The Pharaoh still fears losing control because he still doesn't know God like they do. And while it looks like Pharaoh is going to undo God's plan with evil and subvert good, the opposite actually happens. Listen to this. We'll read this last little bit of the story and then we'll stop from the text. It says in chapter 2, verse 1, "About this time, a man and woman from the tribe of Levi got married. The woman became pregnant and gave birth to a son, and she saw that he was a special baby and kept him hidden for 3 months." Aren't all babies special? That's, you know, that's cute. We all know who's writing this as well, right? Moses is the one writing this. Okay, so he can, a little jokester there. Verse 3, but when she could no longer hide him, she got a basket made of papyrus reeds and waterproofed it with tar and pitch, and she put the baby in the basket and laid it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile River. The baby's sister then stood at a distance, watching to see what would happen to him. Soon Pharaoh's daughter came down to bathe in the river, and her attendants walked along the riverbank. When the princess saw the basket among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it for her. And when the princess opened it, she saw the baby. The little boy was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This must be one of the Hebrew children," she said. And then the baby's sister approached the princess. "Hey, should I go and find one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" she asked. "Yes, do," the princess replied. So the girl went and called the baby's mother. "Take this baby and nurse him for me," the princess told the baby's mother. "I will pay you for your help." So the woman took her baby home and nursed him. Later, when the boy was older, his mother brought him back to Pharaoh's daughter, who adopted him as her own son. The princess named him Moses, for she explained, "I lift him out of the water." Man, this is a very interesting story, isn't it? You think evil's winning, and there's a lot of death and destruction as a result of Pharaoh's fear. But then we start seeing a glimmer of hope. Isn't it interesting, too, that the story slows down here and just focuses on these obscure parents? They're not even named. Just a Levi, man and a woman. They get together and they have a baby. It's really, I mean, there's no dramatic display of power. There's no miracles yet. We don't see any plagues or anything like that yet in the story. We just see a mom trying to protect her son. Beneath all of this, if we look a little closer, we begin to realize that God is actually at work, and that's where we start to see the subversion turn on its head. Let me give you this point, and then I'll explain it. God often begins deliverance in unexpected ways. It's always unexpected to us. Never seems the way that we think it ought to seem. We want a display of power. And God's like, you know what? Two people got together and they had a family. In the midst of all this chaos, with this decree from the government that says you need to kill your son. In the midst of the suffering, in the midst of the oppression, God's still working. Unexpectedly, Pharaoh commanded the boys to be thrown in the river, but the river, the very river that was meant for death, becomes the place where God preserves the life of the future deliverer for the Israelites who were being oppressed. And it happens against all odds. I mean, Moses' mother technically obeys Pharaoh's command here, doesn't she? She puts him in the river, but she just puts him in this little basket that she waterproofs to see if he'll be okay. And it's very interesting because in the text, the Hebrew language actually says it's an ark. Where else do we hear that word? Noah, right? Only two places in the entire Old Testament that that word is used. For Noah's ark, and now we're connecting it to this ark. There's a salvation moment about to happen here, right? That's what the text wants us to know. Just like Noah was preserved through the waters of death and chaos, Moses is now being preserved through the waters of death and chaos. Who did that for Noah? God, right? We're making the connections now. God's starting to show up, even though he's not named directly. And then it goes even deeper. Not only does Moses survive, but Pharaoh's own daughter finds him. Oh, the irony. The household meant to destroy the Hebrew and their babies and oppress them becomes the very household God uses to preserve the one who will deliver Israel from that oppression. Beautiful, beautiful irony. And through this unbelievable series of events, Moses' own mother gets to raise him for a season. So she still gets to be with him, but at the command of the princess. And then eventually he's brought in, he's adopted by Pharaoh's daughter to bridge both worlds, the Hebrews and the Egyptians. Which means that while Pharaoh thinks he's controlling the narrative here through fear and power, God's controlling the narrative. And he's preparing deliverance unexpectedly in the background. And he's subverting the evil of Pharaoh's fear. In this context, let me give you a definition here. Deliverance is God rescuing people from powers they cannot overcome on their own. That is what deliverance is. It's God rescuing people who cannot deliver themselves. And that's what Exodus is all about. Israel cannot free itself from Pharaoh's grasp. Pharaoh's power is too great for them. The oppression is too strong. The slavery is too all-consuming and soul-crushing. So let me just ask you, what do you have in your life that feels that exact same way today for you? What in your life feels stronger than you right now? What in your life do you feel like is enslaving you that you cannot free yourself from? Maybe it's anxiety. It keeps tightening its grip on you, no matter how hard you try to calm yourself down at night. Maybe it's shame from your past that still tries to tell you you'll never really change. What you did is who you are. That defines you. Or maybe it's approval and people-pleasing that keeps controlling all your decisions. Or maybe it's an addiction you thought you could stop, but you can't. Or maybe it's anger or lust or depression or bitterness or fear that we're talking about today. No matter how hard you try, you still feel enslaved. It's because there's a problem that we all face that you can't get away from. And it's that we cannot free ourselves from slavery to sin. That's the problem. We can't free ourselves. We don't have the power. See, Exodus isn't ultimately about bad people out there oppressing God's people in here. It's not that the world is bad and that we're good. The problem isn't out there. The problem's inside of all of us. Of course, we can't save ourselves. Of course we can't. We're part of the problem. Israel couldn't overpower Pharaoh. Pharaoh couldn't overpower his fear. He was enslaved to it. And spiritually speaking, we can't overpower our sin either. I know we look at the story and we want to say we're like Israel. We're God's chosen people. And we're just being oppressed. We're victims. Everybody hates us. The world's against us, but God be for us, right? And if we get real, we look at the story and we see that we're actually Pharaoh. And we're the ones with evil hearts that we let fear control every single day. And we need to see that that's the truth here, that God is trying to speak to us if we're learning to listen. It's inside of us. But listen, Exodus 2 is reminding us of something we desperately need to remember. God's power to save is greater than evil's power to destroy. God is more powerful than anything else in the world. Because while Pharaoh's fear destroyed life, God was preserving a deliverer through the most unexpected of circumstances to bring about deliverance. Isn't that beautiful? God was undoing and subverting the effects of evil that was trying to subvert him. And if you know the rest of the Bible, this pattern should start sounding familiar to you, because it wasn't just Moses' story. Another ruler would come about 1,000 or so years later in the Roman Empire this time, and would eventually rise up with fear and insecurity. And he would try to hold on to the power that he had, and he would order the death of all the little boys in the Hebrew or Jewish nation. Do you remember this? A guy named Herod would do this later on. But see, another deliverer would actually be coming into the world under that shadow of death and subverting the very evil that was meant to kill him. See, Jesus entered the world enslaved by fearful people and oppressive powers. He entered into that chaos. And Jesus didn't just come to confront a political power like Moses did and bridge the gap between politics or nations. He came to confront this deeper slavery underneath every human heart. The sin and the shame and the guilt and the death itself that we face. Jesus came to bridge a different kind of gap. An eternal gap that we could never bridge ourselves. See, we can't save ourselves from ourselves. So God sent Jesus to deliver us. That's the gospel truth that we all need today. That's the good news that we read in the Bible. Jesus stepped into our suffering, into our weakness, into our fear, into death itself for us. And on the cross, it looked like evil had won. It looked like the evil one had subverted everything that God had tried to do to bring salvation to his people. He had to go through the waters of death and chaos just for us. But salvation came in the most unexpected of ways. Because 3 days later, when it looked like all hope was lost, Jesus walked out of the grave alive and subverted the very evil that was trying to take his life. And his resurrection, God's declaration is that he has the power to save. And it's greater than any earthly power that would seek to destroy you and me and to enslave us. Which means if Jesus really is alive and you truly believe that today, then the thing that you fear most is no longer that big in comparison to him. I'm not saying it's not hard. I'm not saying you're not being oppressed. I'm not saying it's not suffering. You might be suffering so much today. But what this teaches us is that God is so much greater in comparison if we will believe him. And he proved that by raising Jesus from the dead. Failure, rejection, suffering, your past, your sin, and death itself. It's not that big compared to God's power anymore, because Jesus already overcame all of that for us. And that's why the fear of the Lord frees us from every lesser fear. Because when you know the God who defeated death itself, you no longer have to live enslaved to anything else but to him. You become his slave. And guess what? Jesus says that when you take on his burden and his yoke, it's easy and light. It's freedom. When you become enslaved to God, he frees you from enslavement to every other thing in your life that would seek to keep you down and destroy you. So I just want to invite you today, believe that God really is bigger than the things that you fear the most. Believe that today. God wants you to know it. He's bigger than the sin that keeps pulling you down. He's bigger than the shame that keeps accusing you. He's bigger than the fear that keeps controlling you. He can really deliver you from whatever it is that's keeping you enslaved, because the resurrection of Jesus proves God's power over it. He proves it. So if you're not a Christian yet, man, and you're here today, I'm glad you're here. I know you probably still have questions that you need answered. We all have questions. I still have questions, even as a believer myself. I want to encourage you, though, put your faith in Jesus. And I want to invite you to trust in him and his power. Maybe for the very first time today. You might not have expected it. Maybe you came in here and it felt like God has just been absent in your life. Like we see at the beginning of the story, God just seems like he's not there. You know, you don't see God mentioned in your story at all. You've had things happen that you've suffered through or whatever. It feels like God's not present. I want to tell you, I believe by faith that he's been working underneath of the whole story, controlling the whole narrative, subverting the very evil that you might have experienced in your life. And now he wants to subvert the evil that you've succumbed to in your heart, and he wants to save you. He's willing to do that if you'll put your trust in him. He will deliver you if you'll let him today. You might not have expected it coming in here, but he will. You don't have to keep trying to save yourself. God is ready and willing to rescue anyone who puts their faith in him. But listen, if you are a Christian here today, I want to invite you to trust God again with his promises. And in those places where you still feel enslaved, we all have things that we continue to go back to. It's like a dog going back to our vomit, right? We have those moments. Some of us are still trying to free ourselves from things that only God can truly free us from and deliver us from. Some of us are still exhausted. We're exhausting ourselves trying to manage our fear instead of surrendering whatever it is that makes us afraid to God. Are you more fearful of embarrassment or being oppressed for your faith or something like losing your job or whatever it might be than you are of missing out on God's blessings for your life? Just think about it that way. Think about that. You might be afraid of things in your life. You're not willing to stand up for what's right, that you know God would have you stand up for. You're not willing to share the gospel in moments where you know you need to speak up because you're too afraid or whatever it might be. What if you were more fearful of missing out on what God has for your life in obedience than you were of anything else? What if his power became so great that you were afraid to miss out on the blessings that he has for you? And that controlled your life. That fear controlled every decision that you make instead of all the other fears that we go through. I'm going to invite us to pray and practice obedience here in just a moment. That's how we respond every week as a church when we hear God's word preached. We pray, we practice obedience through communion. So in just a moment, I'm going to invite you to come and get the elements for communion. You can do that after we pray. And if you're not a believer in the room, I just ask that you wouldn't take communion with us yet. This is a symbol for those of us who want to commit to follow Jesus. We recognize what he's done for us. We are putting our faith in him. So you can come down and get your elements and hold them at your seat because I'm going to lead us in taking communion together. But before we do that, I want to spend some time in prayer. And I just want to ask you, we have that card that's on your seat. We know that God delivers us from things and to things. On one side, you're going to see it says, God, deliver me from. And on the other side, you're going to see that it says, God, deliver me into. And man, as we set this up for the whole series, because we're going to see this theme over and over again, we just thought it would be really important for us to spend a few moments considering how God is freeing us from things in our life, but how we also need him to free us into good things in our life. And so I hope that you guys will take a few moments to consider this. Consider how God is going to free you from things and deliver you from things. Maybe you need him to deliver you from fear, or shame, or control, or anxiety, or addiction, self-reliance, or something else. Man, take a few minutes to write that down on that card. Maybe it's a couple of things. Just do that right now where you are. Just take it out and write it down. What do you need God to free you from in this life? Name some things that you're aware of that you need him to deliver you from that still feel enslaving to you. We have pens in the back of the pews. You can use those if you need them. Whatever it is for you, write that down. Because we're going to pray over that in a moment. You're going to ask God to deliver you from these things, whether it's from sin or, again, whatever it is. You write that in there. You know what it is that might be enslaving you. But then we're going to ask him to save us into something, which, again, we'll be talking more about as the series goes on, especially next week. We'll talk more about this in general. But he wants to save us into the blessings, like the midwives. He wants to save us into his mission with him. He wants to save us into good things through our obedience. So complete that statement where it says, God, deliver me into something. What do you hope for in your life? What do you want God to deliver you into? Now, he may say no, but you can still ask him, because maybe if by his grace you're praying in his will, you're asking for things like peace, trust, freedom, obedience in a sin area, courage, joy, surrender, or deeper intimacy with him. Those are all promises that he gives us in the Bible. So you can certainly ask God to deliver you into those promises that he's made for you. And after you've just taken a moment to write both of those things on the card, I want you to go ahead and come up. This is a symbolic altar for us where, you know, an altar is where you put things to death. And I want you to take this card and pray over both of those things. And I want to encourage you to take this home with you. Stick it in your Bible or your notes. Stick it next to your phone in your pocket. Put it up on your mirror at home. Remind yourself that you're praying these things in your life and you believe that God has the power to deliver you from something and into something greater. So I want to encourage you, let's go ahead and respond in these ways now. Come and pray and then get your elements for communion. I'll lead us in taking communion in just a few moments, but let's respond.
Thanks so much for listening with us today. We hope that it was an encouragement to you. But you know, we don't see this as a replacement for gathering with other believers in a local church context. So if you don't have a local church, we would encourage you to plug in with one wherever you are. And if you're in Roanoke, Virginia, we'd love to invite you to plug in with us here at Redemption Church. And you're welcome anytime to gather with us, but you can check us out online at our website, redemptionroanoke.com. You can look for other content or resources there. But thanks again for listening.